Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, this is Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Steph, and I'm here with Teresa, Linda, Heather, Nicola, and Pat.
Hello!
This week is our 66th episode, Wow. And we are going to look at writing for magazines. And we'll hear from magazine writing expert Patsy Collins, who's got some great tips for you. Before that, we're going to hear from Nicola's work in progress, and then we'll be offering her feedback and critique just the way we do in our Write Club meetings. Teresa's going to talk about her word of the week. And at the end of the show, Linda and Eve White are going to share what's on their bedside tables. But before all that, Pat is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay. This was the author's fourth novel about a man born out of wedlock to a woman who becomes a feminist icon. He grows up to be a writer. Unlike nearly all of this author's novels, it features a complex Dickensian plot which spans the protagonist's whole life.
Oh, feminist mothers ringing bells.
I wonder if it's a British book.
Published in 1978, the book was a bestseller for several years. It was a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction in 1979, and its first paperback edition won the award the following year. And in 1982, a movie adaptation of the novel was released, starring Robin Williams as the protagonist.
Oh. So, can we have clue three, please?
Mm-hmm. The novel contains several memorable features, including a group of women who cut off their own tongues in solidarity with a young rape victim and a transsexual ex-football player.
I have no idea. No, if I'd read that, I'd remember.
Yeah, really.
No idea at
really,
all.
Really stumped us.
Okay. Oh, I would have thought Linda would get this one.
I didn't.
No.
No.
It's The World According to God.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
By John Irving.
Yes, that was a great book.
It was the first one of his that I read, and it was huge in the States in the 80s,
right,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Right, but I didn't. I think the first clue threw me off because it was someone who was born to out of wedlock to a feminist, and I was kept trying to figure that out.
I kind of want to read it now.
it's a good book.
I'm buying no
more
books.
I don't know how it would. I haven't read it since the 80s, so I'm not sure whether it would be of its time. Mm. But it started me on a whole John Irving thing for a long time. I picked this up from Goodreads. There's a scene in this book where it's revealed that a high-up publisher gives all his manuscripts to his cleaning lady. And she's the one that tells him whether they're worth publishing or not. When he asks her why she read a particularly disturbing novel, she answers, to find out what happens next. And later she adds, a book's true when you can say, yeah, that's how damn people behave all the time. And I thought, that's a useful lesson for all of us, probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it does say a lot about John Irving, because despite all the outrageousness of his characters, and there are usually outrageous characters in his novels, they behave the way real people behave.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Thank you, Pat.
Okay.
That was great. Now, Nicola, we seem to be dwelling on the opening of your Taurus trilogy. How many versions are there now?
if you recall, there's a resuscitation scene with Reg and Pam, which has subsequently been cut completely.
Right.
Although it might be about to make a resurgence. And this came to me the other day because I was trying to get into, introduce the character and make her more sympathetic to the reader. So it's a completely different opening, but I might cobble the two together now, I think.
Okay. Go for it.
The tall young woman walked fast down the tiny street as if the demons of hell were behind her. Her long legs ate up the cobblestones and her auburn hair streamed out behind her as she leaned in against the wind, which funnelled down the narrow seaside street as if it was coming straight from the Arctic to cut right through her. Dark grey and black clouds scuttered by, over ready to drop their load of hail or even snow on the unwary. When she reached the gleaming navy door, she stabbed at the brass lock with her key, her hands shaking. Once inside, Brienne stood with her back to the door, breathing deeply. Normally a welcome haven, she stared unseeingly through the open-plan living room and kitchen as if it were a foreign landscape. Everything looked so familiar, but like it belonged to someone else. Nobody ever talks about what happens after the funeral, when the wake finishes and everyone heads home to their normal lives. She walked through to the kitchen and threw her bag onto the kitchen table, hardly noticing that her purse and a palm-sized shell fell out. She turned to flick the switch on the kettle and then opened the cupboard to get out a wine glass instead. Turning to the fridge, she hesitated, taking out the Sauvignon Blanc. While the kettle boiled, she poured a large glass of the wine and lifting it to her mouth, she half-drained it. Brienne sat at the kitchen table and looked out on the tiny back garden that had once been her pride and joy. It was all very bare, all cut back, ready for spring, and while the lone local robin hopped about on the bird table looking for crumbs and tilting his head at her, there were no other signs of life. You would never know you were in the middle of a town. Such a wonderful send-off. Who would have known he was so loved? His mother obviously didn't know Alec at all, confining her limited interest to his infrequent visits to her modern, impersonally decorated bungalow 30 miles away. Beige ruled, according to Alec. He never took Brienne there, only visiting out of duty and guilt. While his mother had undoubtedly loved him in her own way, that love had petrified at the very moment when he left home, where he was no longer an accessory to or reflection of her own life. Choosing to play Giorgio Moroder's Electric Dreams in the middle of the funeral as one of Alec's favourite songs proved that. Brienne smiled a tiny smile as she remembered the baffled looks and hastily smothered grins of Alec's friends as the incongruous guitar solo blared endlessly around the crematorium. She had provided a list of tunes Alec had always said he wanted played at his funeral, but that had largely been ignored. The one song he'd really loved, the Willie Nelson version of The Scientist from the film The Judge, had been played right at the beginning when everyone was filing in and still chatting. Nobody had heard it and Brienne was still angry about that. She jumped as the phone rang in her bag and tipped out the rest of her contents in order to get to it before it stopped ringing. "You're all right. That was a bit of a hasty exit." Her sister Megan's voice echoed in the quiet kitchen. "Sure you don't want me to come over?" "Now I've got to face the place on my own at some point and I've just had enough of all that fake chit-chat." And everyone smiling with relief it's all over. For them. "Okay, well let me know if you change your mind. See you soon. Goodbye, Megan." Brienne ended the call and sat in the quiet kitchen, still watching the robin, all the more aware of the silence now the kettle had stopped boiling. "I'll do it when he flies away."
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, very tense ending there. Very, strong.
Yes.
I managed to get my MacGuffin in.
So yes.
The idea is the opening. I've learned subsequently that the opening should have your villain, your MacGuffin, and your protagonist and the victim. So I've added a line where the villain is seen as standing at the end of the road.
Okay. Well, right.
So but you didn't read that. No.
Okay. Interestingly, because you said you're thinking of reinstating the resuscitation scene, what I actually wrote when I critiqued this the other day. I'm interested to know where you go next. Cut to white room?
Yeah, you know, it's either going to be the limbo scene or the resuscitation scene.
You don't need to, you know, we know that, we suspect she's contemplating suicide.
Yeah.
And then cut to the white room. Anyway, that was my thought.
There is actually a bit more where I actually take her upstairs and lie her down on the bed and things.
Yeah.
So.
Heather?
I enjoyed it. The very silly comment really was, you don't need to say local Robin.
No, I noticed that when I read it.
And I say, I crossed out quite a lot of adjectives. You seem to be using twice as many adjectives as you need. Mm. And the first thing, when I read the first sentence, the tall young woman walked fast down the tiny street, etc., I instantly thought, why are you telling me she's tall? I don't need to know that. Mm. And in the next sentence, you say her long legs. So you doubly don't need it.
Mm. For me, I would cut out the whole of the first paragraph and the first sentence of the second paragraph and start at Brienne stood with her back to the door, breathing deeply. Mm. This, to me, that's where the story starts.
Oh, okay.
I don't think we need to know what the weather's like outside.
I do try in my descriptive passages.
So, but, you know, very often they say, take your first paragraph out and see what difference it makes. Because sometimes your first paragraph is a limbering up exercise to get the words flowing. Mm-hmm. And I think it works really well from that second paragraph.
Well, I like that. Yeah. I like the first because I like knowing that she was coming from someplace and then she gets in her house. Mm-hmm. You know, she's escaped the outside world and here she is. I like the going the walk down. Mm-hmm. You don't have to make it, it doesn't have to be that long, but that detail. And I was thinking that she's using more adjectives because we forced her to give up adverbs.
She's not giving up adverbs.
No, no, no. I think
really?
You know, like, you know, narrow seaside street. Narrow street's enough. You know, you said the local Robin. Yes. You know, you don't need local. No.
Yeah.
You know, we know he's local, he's in your garden.
Yes.
So I just felt there was a lot of, you know, where you use two adjectives, where one was adequate.
You know me and my rule of three. Never do anything unless you can get three.
Yeah. What I thought you could lose, and this is just my feeling, nobody ever talks about what happens after the funeral when the wake finishes and everyone heads home to their normal lives. If you leave that out, it has more impact, I think, when you come to the funeral and we understand that she's been at a funeral.
Oh, okay.
But that's just my opinion.
Yeah.
And I felt, I wasn't sure what we gain, and maybe it's one of your five things that I'm not quite, about, you know, this talking about his mother in, you know, I'm not sure that this bitterness that Brianne feels is endearing her to the reader.
No.
Do we need to know this stuff about his mother? Or does it just make Brianne seem a bit bitchy, a bit?
She's actually she's an anti-hero.
Okay.
She's has anyone ever read Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever?
Mm.
Right. Well, he was a thoroughly unlikable protagonist for at least the first book, wasn't he? Yeah. You really got he got on your nerves.
So we're not meant to like her.
Not necessarily. No, no. She's supposed to be a selfish, self-obsessed character who takes the easy way out.
Okay.
You know, I don't want her to be that likable. I want you to understand that she's unhappy.
In which case, you could be stronger.
Oh, okay.
And actually,
about her sister, her mother, everybody. Nobody understands. Nobody knows what I'm going through.
And in actual fact, quite a bit of that section I thought was quite confusing. Because at first I thought about choosing to play The Electric Dreams. I assumed that Brianne had chosen it.
In terms of naming the music, I mean, I know Giorgio Moroder's Electric Dreams, so I understood.
Yeah.
But if people that are reading it don't understand that reference, and it's very much a song of its time, then you're going to lose people.
Mm.
And I have no idea who the Willie Nelson version of the scientist from the film Judge is. And I think that's actually detracting from the message. So the one song that he really loved had been played right at the beginning and nobody heard it.
Yeah.
Is enough.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because then we can all fill in what that song was.
Right.
Okay. Whereas when you tell us that, it's a bit like...
Then you need to go and find it on YouTube.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like an information dump.
Yeah. And it's like, is it relevant?
The point is, as Stephanie says, that she didn't get to control the funeral and the song that she chose that she knew was his favourite, nobody heard.
Mm. Yeah.
It doesn't actually matter what the song is. I think that's the point you're making.
Okay.
Unless you use it later.
Well, I've got a decision to make on this one because there's a lot of musical references right through the book and I don't want to take them all out, but I take your point about that. When I read it, it felt like it went on, that bit went on too long. Yeah. It was too detailed.
I mean, you could maybe look at taking part of the lyrics or... I mean, certainly I've used music in mine, but I haven't named the songs. I've really used the lyrics. So I've got her people singing the lyrics to one another. Because to me, the one song he'd really loved that talks about and then use a line from it or something,
In one of J.K. Rowling's As Robert Galbraith, one of the Cuckoo's Calling sort of series, features Cormoran Strike is the son of a rock star, lead singer with a particular
group. I've seen some of the TV series,
And he uses the lyrics of real, some real songs, some real music, as the, what do you call it, at the beginning of the
paragraph?
That's the ones, epigraphs at the start of each chapter.
Yeah, nice. I like that.
So you could do that.
Something like that might work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can leave that in. I'm just saying, from a reader's point of view, when you don't know, because I knew when I thought Giorgio Moroder's Electric Dreams, because I know that song and I like that song, I completely got the reference, but I have no idea who the scientist from the film Judge is, so it meant nothing to me, and it just jarred.
Yeah. Well, it all sounded too detailed when I read it, so I think that's what the benefit of reading.
But you're
out
trying
now,
to say, we get what you're trying to say. You're trying to say Brianne's really, really fed up. Because his mother took over, didn't consider her feelings at all, and she's, you know, she's the one that's been hurt, she's the one that's been damaged, and nobody's paying any attention to us. And you want us to think of her as unsympathetic to his mother.
Yeah, so a selfish, self-obsessed person, that's what she starts out.
I mean, that's...
I don't think she does.
No, I don't think she's...
I'm not making her nasty enough as
well. That's what you're aiming at. You need to...
I mean, the line where she says... I've got to face the place on my own at some point, and I've just had enough of all that fake chit-chat and everyone smiling with relief that it's all over for them. I thought that was a good line. I like that, the afterthought for them. But I felt it was very poignant. I felt very sad for her.
And what
you're wanting me to think is you were actually wanting me to think, you know, oh, she's full of self-pity and... Mm. It's hard not to feel sorry for somebody that's just lost their partner, isn't
it?
Yeah. I want you to feel point. That's why I wrote it like this, and then I want her to come across as selfish and self-obsessed, like Thomas Covenant was, because the whole point, you know, when you're starting with a negative, you then go into a positive for the second act, the end of the second act.
I get that, and I'm setting up
for the ending where she chooses something you don't expect, because the ending has to be. What was it? You have to have a
kind of
an obvious
resonance.
Ending. Yeah, that's right.
I liked more aware of the silence now the kettle had stopped boiling.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nice way of talking about
it.
Because when the kettle goes click, and it,
then
there's nothing left. I could really get that.
Well, I like this version, the beginning, better than the one that we had before. I mean, you read one some weeks ago, I think, that was...
I can't even remember the second one. It was so bad.
No, it wasn't bad at all. I think the second one was The White Room.
The White Room?
Yeah.
The Limbo. Limbo. That's not the second one. I wrote the second one. It was terrible, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. We all tore it to pieces.
I like this one better than the last two. Yeah.
I like this one much better when we're straight into the grief that she's having.
Yeah,
okay.
I'd agree with that.
Well, I might bring Reg and Pam back, but not give them any names, because I want to introduce the. I've got. This is a good start for me, because I now see how I can knit it together and introduce the main characters all in one hit in the first chapter.
Yeah. Right. Now, why are Reg and Pam coming back? Because they were the people who were trying to resuscitate.
Yeah, but they won't have any names this time, so we won't know they're Reg and Pam.
Oh, okay.
They're going to be incognito.
Okay.
But they're the.
Okay.
The paramedics.
Paramedics.
Yeah.
And I'm struggling. Yeah, well, I'm struggling to sort of link this with that.
Leave it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I quite like the White Room scene, because that takes us into the supernatural fantasy element.
It does. I like
And I think for the reader, they need to... I mean, you've got the palm-sized shell falling out.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was
And I liked that.
That's the MacGuffin.
Yes, but I think maybe we could see that... We could see more of the palm-sized shell.
You do in the next bit.
Yeah, because it feels warm to the touch, doesn't it?
And every time she touches it, it warms up more. So there is about another half of this that we could include today.
Yeah.
I didn't get the reference to the palm-sized shell.
No, I didn't.
She threw a bag on the table.
I knew that was important because the shell comes in later. But
But then if this was an opening, you
wouldn't. No, it's just bringing it to your attention, isn't it?
I didn't know that was the MacGuffin.
I just thought that at some point you'd go, ah, yes.
Yes, exactly.
That is what will happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
But dare I say it, are we still troubling around the beginning instead of just moving on and writing?
I couldn't carry on without knowing what.
Okay.
I have any sense of what the beginning was going to be at all. I just couldn't do it.
Okay. Okay.
Well, our vote,
yes,
is that this is the best of the three,
yes,
so far.
I think so.
I think,
yes,
that's,
apart from me, I like Limbo best.
Oh, I prefer the Limbo, yeah, but that wasn't one of the
that
three openings. Opening.
That wasn't an opening.
The three openings,
no, but I prefer
have been,
it as an opening. I think it works as,
right,
an opening.
I like it as an opening,
well,
too.
Well, it's got no MacGuffins in it, and there's no villain.
Well you know, rules are made to be broken.
Yeah.
Tell me what a MacGuffin is.
It's the thing that people want. So your protagonist has a MacGuffin, which
she's
is
just,
in her case is to meet her husband again or die. The villain always has a MacGuffin, which is could be, you know, the key to the nuclear,
mm-hmm,
shelter or,
right,
whatever.
Okay.
Everyone's always got one. External
desire.
And, yeah, an object of desire, external, mm-hmm, and internal.
Okay, but how is
like,
the...
Like Mary Magdalene wants to go to Little Rock.
Yeah,
you say, normally a welcome haven. She stared unseeingly through the open-plan living room and kitchen as if it were a foreign landscape. Okay. The normally a welcome haven has to then relate to the subject of your sentence. And the subject of your sentence is she. She stared unseeingly. Right? But in fact, the welcome haven is the
open-plan
living room and
okay,
kitchen. So it needs to be. She stared unseeingly through the open plan living room and kitchen, normally a welcome haven, as if it were a
foreign landscape.
Very
and
nice.
So
much
just
better.
Cut open plan. Why have you put that? You don't need that.
Yeah. Because you can't see through walls, Teresa.
Yes,
right.
But it's obvious. You don't need to tell us.
Oh, right. Okay. Show, not tell.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I hope that's been useful,
yes,
to us. And if anybody out there wants to vote for which of the three starts to the Taurus trilogy they want, do let Nicola know.
I'm sure there's lots of people who care very much about that.
Well, and some people might vote for The White Room, which has not been offered as an opening, but Teresa's voting for that. So we'd love to know what you think anyway. So now it's over to Teresa. You've been looking at a word of the week for us.
Well, yes, as we're discussing magazine fiction, I thought I'd look into the word magazine. And in the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, the first definition they give is a print periodical containing miscellaneous pieces, such as articles, stories, poems, often illustrated, as in a fashion magazine, a gardening magazine, or such a periodical published online. But why is it that we call a periodical a magazine? That was the question that I wanted to answer. We also use magazine to talk about a similar section of a newspaper, that's in a Sunday supplement, a radio or television programme presenting several short segments on a variety of topics. But another meaning of the word magazine, a place where goods or supplies are stored, a bit like a warehouse. A room in which powder and other explosives are kept in a fort or a ship, mm-hmm, or the contents, mm-hmm, of such a magazine, munitions, stocks of provisions or goods, or a supply chamber such as the holder in or on a gun for cartridges is also called a magazine. And one I hadn't come across before, a light-proof chamber for films or plates on a camera or for film on a motion picture projector is the magazine, which I didn't know. Mm. From Etymology Online, I discovered that from the 1580s, the word magazine was used as a warehouse place for storing goods, especially military ammunition. Coming from the Middle French magasin, meaning warehouse, depot, or store in the 15th century. Going back from that, the Italian magazzino, and interestingly, and I didn't know this, from the Arabic makhazin, which is the plural of maksan or storehouse. So that's come into Spanish. Mm. As almacén, warehouse magazine, from the verb casana, to store up. The original sense as a warehouse is almost obsolete. The meaning of a cartridge chamber in a repeating rifle is also obsolete by 1868, and that of a case in which a supply of cartridges carried is obsolete by 1892. However, the meaning periodical journal containing miscellaneous writings dates from the publication of the first one, The Gentleman's Magazine, in 1711. So much as the first theatre built in Elizabethan London was called the theatre. Mm. The first magazine was called Gentleman's Magazine. And it was so called from an early use of the word for printed lists of military stores and information. Or, in a figurative sense, from the publication being a storehouse of information.
Mm.
So this phrase, storehouse of knowledge, has been applied to books as early as the 1630s. So magazine has, it's from that meaning, a storehouse of knowledge, we've come to call periodicals magazines.
Fantastic.
That's very
I wonder if they included the Almanac of Ladies of Covent Garden.
Well, that's an almanac, that's a different thing.
Thank you, Teresa, and it's nice to know that a magazine is a store of knowledge, because I like to think of Write Club the podcast as a magazine programme.
Oh, nice segue.
A store of knowledge for all of you. So Teresa and I were lucky enough to meet with Patsy Collins recently, and Patsy not only writes magazine fiction, she also runs the WOMAG Writers Blogspot, which is a news site for all sorts of things to do with writing for magazines. So let's have a listen to that interview now.
We're delighted to welcome Patsy Collins, successful author of numerous short stories that regularly appear in women's magazines around the world, and author of five novels to boot. Welcome, Patsy, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Patsy, how long have you been writing?
Seems like forever sometimes. I actually started in 2001, pretty much by accident. I'd moved to a new area and I had a new job and things like that. So I wanted something to do which would fill in some time. And as I think you all know, writing is pretty good at doing that. So I took some creative writing evening classes. I was just going to do one term and do it for fun. But our tutor was very encouraging about sending things off. And I actually won a short story competition, only 40 words. But as the prize, I got tea and cake with the mayor and a book token. So I thought, well, maybe I'll do a bit more of this.
That's fabulous. So how did that lead you into writing for magazines?
Well, the same tutor was very encouraging towards that. She used to write. She writes in several genres, and she's now got a book deal with Orion and things, but one of the things she did was writing for women's magazines. Obviously she knew about it, and if she thought we weren't in any way suited to that, she would try and steer us in that direction. And fortunately I was, eventually I found out I was suited to that. It did take a long time. I was lucky because she was she almost made us submit. It was easier to submit something than tell her we hadn't. So I was submitting probably before I was ready, but I never had that bit. A lot of people get nervous about submitting. I'd already sent stuff in and got rejected before I reached that stage. So I was fortunate in that way that I didn't get stressed out. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I was just getting what were clearly standard rejection slips because, other people were reading the same things out word for word. I mean, they were nicely worded, but it was standard. And a couple of magazines kept sending their guidelines again. And I thought, oh dear, I'm obviously not hitting the mark. And then one day I just got no compliment slip or anything. There was just a magazine. It was the lady in an envelope addressed to me. And my initial reaction is, oh, they're now showing me how it should be done. Mm. Now I flicked through to find the story and just started reading. And I started thinking, well, this is no different than the kind of thing I write. And I had to get a long way down before I realised the reason it was so like what I write is because I had actually written it. I don't know what's happened. They did used to send out acceptance slips and things, but that had somehow got missed. And I just got the thing. And I was so, once I did realise, obviously I was very excited. And my poor husband, I was jumping around the house, holding the magazine, too excited to speak. And I think he thought I was having some kind of, epileptic fit or something. That was really exciting. And then not that long after, I got an email acceptance from a magazine, which was the new, the weekly news are still going as of right then, which was really good and exciting as well. But unfortunately, that made me think I'd made it. So the next few rejections really, they did hurt. So I have got plenty of sympathy for people that got knocked back by rejections. But I did keep going and sell quite regularly now.
So do you submit on paper or do you submit by email?
Email. Most magazines now accept by email. Some will only accept by email. Some are different. The People's Friend, you have to submit to them by paper unless you're accepted. They have different editors and they all have different requirements. So if you do get accepted by them, you may be able to email in. I'm fortunate that everywhere I submit is by email now.
And you mentioned, you know, you won that 40 word competition before you were successful submitting to a magazine. So is there a difference in how you write for competitions and how you write for magazines?
Yes and no. The basic rules, you know, the spelling and grammar and things like that, obviously are the same. Everybody wants an engaging story. They want good characters, good dialogue, all that kind of thing. So the basic rules are the same. It's more the genre. There does seem to be a feeling about some people that if, as it, with the women's magazines, if they're sort of lighthearted and uplifting and very easy to read, some people feel that's not quite as worthy as something that's depressing or very literary. Obviously, I'm biased, so I disagree with that. But they're, you know, not all stories are interested in something that a women's magazine's written. I mean, it depends on the tone of the competition and the style. Obviously, if they've given you a genre or an idea of a style, you go with that. But I have that first story I mentioned that I first had published. I'd originally sent it to competition and it hadn't won. But my tutor, you know, convinced me it just hadn't won. And with competitions, there can only be one winner. There might be in a few places. If you don't win the competition, that doesn't mean that your story is not very good. I've now judged competitions myself. And sometimes some really good stories don't get placed simply because there's even better stories ahead of them. Where a magazine's different, if they like 10 stories that day, they may be able to take them all and then use them throughout the year and not take them. But I've done it the other way as well. I have written stories aimed at a magazine. They didn't take it and it's then won a competition. So it is possible to do that. But you have to be honest and look at yourself. There's no point looking at things you've aimed at magazines and they failed to sell and just send them to competitions. You have to work out why they didn't sell. If it's because they're no good, they're not going to win competition, or, you know, if they need work. It's wrong to say if they're no good. I've never come across a story that is absolutely no good in any way. There's always something, but quite often it can be improved. But if the reason it didn't sell to a magazine is just that it wasn't right for the magazine, then it's worth trying it for somewhere else. But if when you get it back, it's much easier once you've had something back and it didn't win a place or got rejected to look through and be more honest with yourself where it needs some improvement.
So how do you assess what a magazine is looking for? You simply pick it up and read all the stories in it?
That's definitely a good start. I would caution anyone that's done that. I've come across quite a few people that read old copies of the magazine to do that, and they do change, so it must be current ones if you're going to do that. And don't just stick at the stories. If you look at all the adverts, you can see who the magazine thinks they're aiming at. If you look at the letters pages and things like that, that gives you an idea of the type of people you're aiming at. And you don't necessarily have to write for the same people. For example, the People's Friend magazine, not exclusively, but quite a lot of their readers are middle-aged and older. That doesn't mean the characters have to be, it just means the story has to appeal to that kind of people. But it's also a good idea to find out as much as you can going around the magazine. And the People's Friend, again, the editor there has a blog, and she will say, you know, what particular length she's looking for. Some of the editors send out emails to regular contributors saying what themes they're looking for or what time of year that they're going to have the stories, so have a look at that. I also, my own blog, Womag Writer, I put any details I come across there, and sometimes other people say, oh, I've just had a story accepted, it was whatever length, I think they're looking for those, that kind of thing. So I know I'm biased because it's my blog, but that can be quite helpful to keep up to date with things. Yeah. For example, You Magazine in South Africa, they're normally open to submissions for anyone, but they've closed for 6 months, only to submissions, they're still using work. But, you know, there's no point you spending a long time crafting a story aimed just at them to be used in 4 months' time, because they won't have bought it. So,
So our listeners can look at your blog. It's Womag Writer.
Yeah, womagwriter.blogspot.uk.
Lovely, thank you. We'll put a link to that on our Facebook group.
Yeah, I've put all the guidelines on there, and there's sometimes I've had editors and things on where you can ask questions, but you can ask questions of each other, any news that have heard about. Always happy to hear about people that have had successes, especially the first success or something like that. Sometimes I've had guests on like that, which is
I've had a look. It's a great resource, actually. Just backtracking a little bit, something you said earlier, which I think the implication was, stories for women's magazines generally need to be uplifting. Is that fair? Or
yes, I would say so. The reason people are reading those stories, that they're probably doing it in a coffee break at work, or if it's a mum at home, you know, she's snatched a few minutes to herself. So they don't want to be really complicated and challenging. That doesn't mean they can't be deep and make you think, but they want to be fairly easy read. And yet people generally want to be uplifted. It doesn't mean it has to be happy ever after and every end tied up. I mean, sometimes there are, you know, tearjerkers work because it's a kind of therapeutic thing, but there should still be a bit of hope at the end. There have been stories about, you know, bereavement and things, but then there's hope for the future that the person will be happy. But I mean, it hasn't got to be all jolly and candy floss, although, you know, humour is good, just light-hearted quirky stories can work with a magazine. It all depends, but yeah, generally you want to make the reader happier by the end, or more optimistic, not depressed.
Are there any subjects that are completely taboo in magazines?
Sexual violence against anyone, but violence against children, things like that, that I think would be quite obvious. Most things, it's not as obvious, you know, not as many taboos as you might think. It's more in the tone, how you handle it. I think we're all familiar with, like, cozy crime mysteries on, you know, you wouldn't want to hear about graphic details of a murder, but a cozy crime story or Agatha Christie might be okay. So it's sort of handling the way you handle it. So as I said, bereavement can work. I've sold stories about people who've lost a child, and then the child's been an organ donor and things like that. So it's, you've got the sadness on one side and the, you know, the hope on the other. But it's in the way you handle it. And some things you might you know, they're bringing more topical things, like, for example, people who are transgender and things like that. The story wouldn't necessarily be about that issue, but it could be mentioned, things like that. It's always worth, have a look through the magazine. It's always worth pushing, you know, trying to push the boundaries just a tiny bit. There's no point putting in something completely opposite to what they do, but they may not have had a story on a particular issue just because nobody's sent one in yet. It might not be because they're unwilling to do it. Sometimes you'll get feedback from the editors, you know, and you'll know that's just not the right subject for them. But you know, if you don't, it's worth trying. It's always difficult to know. If you send in a story that has a potentially controversial theme and it's rejected, it's tempting to think that's why it was rejected, But it may be because they've just accepted another one with the same theme, or, you know, there may be some other reason they rejected it.
And have any of your short stories kind of triggered ideas for longer fiction? You know, you've got 5 novels under your belt. Are any of those derived from short stories?
Sometimes, yeah. The first one I wrote, not the first one I had published, but Paint Me a Picture, that started as a short story. When I got to 130,000 words, I still didn't know how it would end. I did realise it would be a novel. I clearly knew nothing about writing novels at that time. So I put it aside, learned on work writing novels, and I wrote Escape to the Country, which actually won a novel writing competition. That was how it was first published. Right. And then I came back to Paint Me a Picture and rewrote it. It's still a long novel, but not that long. And it does now have an ending, which is quite good, I think. Top tip there. If you write a novel, end it eventually.
Yes. Very good. Very good. And are there many magazines still looking for stories? Because we maybe have the impression that the market has shrunk in the last couple of decades.
It definitely has. Before, when I was first starting to write, there were a lot more markets. And even at that point, it had been shrinking. And there's also more people writing. I think it's definitely getting more competitive. But that doesn't mean there's not a chance of getting published. There are quite a few magazines that will consider work from anybody, whether you've, you know, been published or not. The People's Friend are particularly encouraging you that way. They, you know, they often state that they are looking for new writers, and, you know, can be quite encouraging. If people are fairly close, they will often give a bit of advice. It's getting harder and harder for all editors to do that, because there's, you know, publishing magazines is a business, there's limited time and there's more competition, but they're particularly good. The Weekly News, which is also owned by DC Thompson, anyone can submit work to them. Ireland's Own, in Ireland, obviously, you can submit to them. There's a Swedish magazine, Alice, you can submit to them. That's Life Fast Fiction in Australia, Woman's World in Australia, That's Life Fast Fiction in Australia and Woman's World in America. You can send to them. There's Yours Magazine, Spirit and Destiny, Your Cat, Woman's Weekly. They're all magazines you can submit to, but I would caution you, they take all rights. Some people don't worry about that. I personally will not sell all rights to my stories, so for me, that's a lost market. But that's,
well, that would mean you could no longer take it and put it into an anthology of your work.
All rights means exactly what it says. It's absolutely all rights. That includes your moral right to be associated with that story. So, you know, they can sell it. If they buy all rights, they can sell it and put their own name as the author. They don't. Normally they don't. They will put your name, but it can't be used in any way. It's very unlikely, but, you know, for example, the film War Horse started as a short story. If the author had given up all rights, then they got that. That's not why I'm against it. It's very unlikely your women's magazine story will be made into a film, but
but there's a principle there, isn't there? This is a new phenomenon that we're talking about.
It's coming in. I mean, it used to be First British Serial Rights, and they just bought the rights to use that story in that magazine one time. For quite a while now, there have been extensions to that, so they can use digital versions. They can reuse it in other versions of magazines. Quite often they, you know, syndicate to other places. That's fine. You must read your contract to know what you've got into. But in all those cases, the author can still use it themselves. And you did mention, have short stories ever triggered novels? Well, if your short story triggered a novel idea in you, you're sold all rights on the short story, you then don't have the rights to write that. It's not just that story, it's the characters and any world you've created. I'm not saying a magazine would sue you if you use that character in another story, but technically, if you've given up all rights on that story, that character's not yours as well. So I need to take into account.
Are there there any sort of professional bodies or writers' associations challenging this? I know you as an individual are challenging it.
Yeah, I have another. Other people are looking at it. The two writing magazines, the best-known writing magazine, Writers Forum, they're looking into it and doing what they can. And quite a few different bodies are, but there's a limit to what they can do. I mean, as I said, it is a business, and in some ways you can't blame the magazines and the owners of the magazines for treating it as a business. But I do think the All Rights is unfair, because I think it's perfectly possible for a magazine to take all the rights they want and need and still leave something for the author. And I know it's possible, because lots of magazines.
Mm. And certainly that's how it's worked for the past 100 years or more. So
yeah, I mean, it changes. Everything does change. And there are things, you know, it wasn't that long ago that nobody would have ever thought of magazines being available online, for example.
Mm.
So it's not unreasonable. They update the contracts and things. And some of the magazines that take all rights, they're saying, oh, well, things might change. Well, in that case, change the contract when they do and bring that in. But I may have got a bit of a bee on my bonnet.
No, it's a good tip. It's a great tip.
Yeah.
A great tip. Yeah.
While we're on the subject of it being a business, I know a lot of writers, some writers write professionally full-time, which is fine. Some writers do it as a hobby in their spare time, which is equally fine. Nothing wrong with either of those. But the temptation is to think, you know, if you just write in your spare time and you send off the odd story, and if you're really lucky, you sell one or two, is to think that it's a hobby. There are still some ways you have to treat it as a business. For example, if you've made some money from it, you have to tell the taxman. I know it seems unfair, but you do. You do have to read your contracts and sign them properly. You do have to keep proper records and things. If you've not understood your contract, you don't know that you're going to be, whether you're breaching it or not accidentally. And if you've not kept proper records, that can lead to all sorts of trouble, because if you've given up rights and then try and sell them again, however accidentally, you could end up in trouble with that.
Mm. And am I right in thinking you do all that yourself? You don't have an agent?
No, I do it all myself. If you're selling short stories, I can't imagine an agent would be interested, but they're not the money in it. Maybe if somebody also sells novels, their agent would help them out in that regard. It's not particularly complicated. You just do have to remember to keep records. I personally use a spreadsheet, but there are lots of different ways of doing it, as long as you keep good records.
We've got an aeroplane going overhead at the moment. I don't know if you can hear it.
We'll just ramble on.
I think the Greek Air Force must have had a delivery of fuel or something, because they're passing around today. Right, it's gone now. Okay. We didn't miss anything critical there, did we?
No, I think we're fine. Yeah, okay. So do you have any other insider tips for writing for magazines?
I don't know about insider. I've not got a special chapter I'm just particularly interested in. Through my own stories, but I do have some tips. One is to have a go at writing, and, you know, try sending it out. I would try and get some feedback. If you belong to a writer's group, that's good. If you can't get to a physical one, there's lots of online ones and things. So I would try that. And you don't necessarily have to start with short stories. You know, if you look at the letters pages and the tips and things, that's a really good way to research the market, because you're looking at the magazine and sending it off. And particularly if you're quite new to writing and you're getting in a lot of rejects, having somebody actually pay you for something you've written and put your name on it can be a real boost. And that's what I was doing while I was getting all my initial rejections. I was sending in quite a lot of these silly tips and what my daft man said and all kinds of things. My poor husband, I kept making him say things so I could quote him. But, you know, that can be a moral, you know, a real boost.
That's interesting. That is interesting, yeah.
Yeah, to get things up. One of the things is, I would say, is to look through the magazines on the newsagent shelf, check which you can do through my blog whether they are open to submissions, and then pick the one that you most enjoy the stories for, because there's no point trying to write something that you don't enjoy yourself. It's unlikely you'll do it particularly well, but also you'll be miserable while you're trying. So write the types of stories you want, and there's often quite a broad range, especially those that have more than one story a week. There's often quite a broad range, so you might, you know, if you like writing twist ending stories, write those. If you like romances or mysteries, write those. So yeah, definitely go for the types of stories that you want to. And also, I know rejections are no fun, but try to take them personally. They're not personal. They're just looking for their readers. If they've rejected your story, they might absolutely love it, but it doesn't fit in with the magazine. It might be terrible, of course. Is that possible? I once had a story rejected because my central character was a child on a swing, and she said, "I'm very sorry, I've just accepted. I really love your story, but I've just accepted a story with a child on a swing." And I couldn't change mine. I can't remember the other one. But I personally would have thought, well, it wouldn't worry me if they had two stories a few weeks apart with a child on a swing. But it was perfectly true. I did see that story in the magazine. So, you know, that was just bad luck. Had I got mine in first, the other author wouldn't have sold theirs. So, you know, keep trying. When it comes back, look through, see whether you can improve anything. Maybe, you know, give it a different slant for another story. But keep on going.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm. Well, before you go, do please tell us about your latest book.
I've got so many. I've got quite a lot of short story collections. I do each one by theme. I realised that I've written quite a lot. I'm very keen on gardening, so I've written a lot of short stories involving gardening, quite a lot of romantic ones and family. So I think I've got 15 collections now, each on
different.
But the one I'd most like to plug is, I only wrote half of it. It's called From Story Idea to Reader, and it's a writing guide, but it's a very accessible one for beginners, and it covers, there is quite a lot on writing for women's magazine fiction, but it's also fiction in general, how to get started, some of the details about the business side of it that you need to take into account, writing tips, where to get ideas, things like that. So I think it's excellent.
It sounds good. Brilliant. Yeah, it
sounds lovely.
Okay, well, it's been lovely talking to you, Patsy. Thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with your ongoing magazine fiction.
Thank you very much.
Fascinating.
Yeah, she was really,
really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
For years, at a time when most magazines did contain fiction, I was convinced I could do that. I could write these stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you've got a few now. You might be able to send in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing, like Pat, I was struck by the importance of having a mentor who knows something. You know. She would never have. I was very struck by the fact that the person she went to learn creative writing from knew about the writing for magazine world, and that's quite an esoteric bit of information, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and the fact that she was pushed so hard
to submit things.
I found that fascinating.
Interesting that a number of people we talk to, we say, "How did you get into writing?" I went to a creative writing course in my local college evening courses, and what an inspiration they are!
Right. Yeah.
Yes,
passionate teachers.
Yeah,
I was fascinated by the legal stuff that she talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that you sort of sign over all rights, or potentially you could sign over all rights. And I could see, you know, probably as a fairly new writer, if you did do that, you know, everything's taken from you. You don't own any piece of it.
Well, right, you'd be very excited if they contacted you and said, "We want to use your story."
Yes. Yeah,
and it would be quite a hard decision if you're not an established writer. And she's very. Adamant that she is not going to sign that kind of contract, but you know,
but she's established and said a lot. Yes. But if it was your first opportunity to get your name
in print, you'd be so excited.
You could well want to do that. So I think it's a decision that you have to make from a business point of view. And if you're looking for publication so that you can add to your CV, I have been published in this magazine, maybe you would choose to. But
I found it interesting when she said that, you know, in some cases you can't even use that character.
Well, if you signed all the rights, you couldn't use that character.
If you signed your rights away, you know, sort of, so if you're protagonist, you want to use again and again and again, you know, as lots of authors do.
Yeah.
If you've signed away that right at the beginning, you can't do that.
You have to come up with another one.
Fascinating.
It was.
The other thing I thought was really interesting was on the looking at the demographics of the magazine, not just by like looking at the stories, but looking at everything else around it, the adverts, the letters and all that kind of thing.
That's a really useful tip. Top tip people. About that trying your luck with writing letters. And I thought that was a great tip.
I did think it was funny when she said about getting halfway through a story before she realised it was hers.
Oh, yes.
That's so nice. That's so nice.
You have to be very prolific.
Not to notice.
I think I would. Yeah, and you're talking about the, you know, very specifics. You'll find on her Blogspot, which we'll be putting a link to on our Facebook group, she's actually shared submission guidelines and special quirks of each of the magazines and her personal experience of working with them. So if you are looking to get into magazine publishing, that will be a fantastic resource.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something interesting I discovered, not quite magazine writing, but short story writing, and just to demonstrate the very idiosyncratic nature of submissions. If you want your story read on Radio 4, it has to be exactly between 2,100 and 2,200 words. Radio 4 will only broadcast stories between 21 and 2,200 words.
Whoa,
isn't that incredible? Time.
Very precise.
Yes. I know it is time. And,
because
and,
it's working to it.
But if, you know, if you're writing for radio, who would have known that you've got to start by aiming for no more than 2,200 and no less than 2,100 words. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it's so useful, isn't it, that we have all of these wonderful interviews with people who have more information.
As you are generous with sharing their knowledge and experience. Yeah. And that's the wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I had a look on the WOMAG writer and looked at this huge list of magazines, because we were talking a while ago, weren't we, and saying there doesn't seem to be a market for magazine fiction anymore, but she had this huge list, but not just because I suppose we were thinking from an English UK point of view, but you know, South Africa, New Zealand,
Australia.
America,
she has stuff in Australia, South Africa,
and she's just got a list and you click and they take it takes you to their
submissions page.
Submissions.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. So everybody go and have a look at that. Now I have got, look at that, ladies.
Lots of magazines.
I've got lots and lots of magazines for you. So would anybody want to take one of these magazines and go off and do a submission?
Well, I was thinking I could put back the middle of my story, my All Is Lost moment, and revert it to the short story form that I originally had. But I think I would have to submit it to a magazine in America in the South. And there are a lot of Southern.
I think you're just wrong. Right. You're just wrong. What you're talking about, the only people who'd be interested in this book are people who live in the same place as Mary Magdalene or who'd be interested in the story. And it doesn't make any sense to me. We read stories set in India. We read stories from around the world. We read books written in Africa. You know, we're interested in everything, and I don't understand why you have that kind of view.
Because I think with the language, the way they speak, etc.
It's lovely.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, well, that's really part of its charm.
Yeah, we get it.
Yeah, we do get it. I'm amazed that you were able to find so many book and magazines.
Well, I went to
a dentist surgery.
No, I did not go to a dentist surgery. I went to a supermarket, a well-known high street supermarket in the UK, and I got a writing magazine I have by subscription. But all the others, Woman's Own, That's Life, Woman, My Weekly, Woman's Weekly, The Lady and The People's Friend, I picked all of them up. Because I thought we're going to talk about magazines, and
We should. Yeah, we should all take one and do a little bit of research. And
The lady was the one that the lady was interviewed with.
It was her first one. Yeah,
I've never read The Lady.
How many stories, short stories, are published? Is it just one?
Well, the People's Friend have got seven this episode.
Seven stories.
Seven short stories, and one of them is a serial. So, Pat, there is hope.
Oh, because story.
You can, you know, just as Dickens did. So it's not going to end up as a novel, but there may be half a dozen.
Just looking at the recipe.
You're looking at the recipe. Okay. But there may be half a dozen, you know, six, seven, eight in a series.
Yeah. And there's one, and it might be People's Friend, and I picked this up from the Wellmouth writer, I think. They also do a sort of, not novella, but I can't remember what they called it, but it was like a sort of long, short story, as well as the regular short stories.
Yeah. So there's long, short stories, short stories, serials that go on over time. You know, I mean, seven in The People's Friend. How many are there in this My Weekly?
Look like loads.
Four, five in My Weekly. One, two, three in Woman's Weekly. So, you know, there's a market out there. It might be shrinking. Now, I do apologise to all of our listeners in America because we are talking about UK magazines, but I'm sure it's the same. And we didn't have the chance to go to a US news agent
to
pick
up. But there
are
magazines. I haven't checked lately, but magazines. I used to submit to magazines when I was really early on. And Redbook. And I think it was Redbook, Woman's Day, a lot of things like that. Mm. And so basically we're talking more about women's magazines than anything else. I mean, would you submit anything to Gentleman's Quarterly or?
Yeah, I mean, if that's it, I think that the message that Patsy was giving was go and have a look at the magazine, read the magazine, look at the adverts, try and understand the type of person you're writing for.
Right.
And tailor what you're doing to the audience. Yeah. Read the other stories.
Yeah, we're talking specifically about women's magazines today, but there are other magazines that publish fiction, like The New Yorker. Mm.
Right.
But it's a different genre.
And there are literary magazines, like the London Magazine publishes, but they have very specific guidelines about font, about spacing, you know. Again, it's just like everything else. You must follow the submissions.
Right.
But if you're looking at short stories in women's magazines, go and have a look at Patsy Collins' blog because that will really help. And if anybody out there knows what the current US magazines are, please let us know because we know that, you know, a large number of people are listening in the US.
We're big in Oklahoma.
We are.
Hello, you guys.
Colorado.
So,
is it Colorado?
Colorado.
All right, do that bit again.
We're big in Colorado.
We certainly are.
They love us in Denver.
Yeah. Denver's a big place. So somebody in Denver, please go and have a look in your local, do you call it a news agent, Linda?
Well, yes, but then also usually in the supermarkets at the checkout stand when you're there, they have racks of magazines.
Right, so will you please go into your local supermarket and have a look and see what are the current magazines featuring short fiction and post on the Facebook group for us to let everybody know.
Yes.
And similarly, those guys of you that are in Australia and New Zealand, can you do the same? In fact, everybody, Botswana?
Yeah, why not?
Let's have some news from Botswana. So we're all on the Facebook group, please, ladies and gentlemen.
They can also go into the drugstore, can't they?
They can go into the drugstore or the pharmacy, but mostly it's called the drugstore.
Well, that was really useful, and thanks again to Patsy for all of that help. And as I said, we'll be putting the link to her blogspot on the Facebook group. Now, it's almost time to end this episode of Write Club, the podcast. But before we go, let's ask Eve White, our lovely literary agent friend who we met in January. Eve White, what's on your bedside table?
I'm just a few chapters into Erin Kelly's He Said, She Said, which I was given as a present by a friend. And I hadn't read Erin Kelly before, but she keeps coming up because she's reviewed some of my clients. She's reviewed Ruth Ware, and Ruth Ware has a quote on the front of Erin's book, and she's reviewed Sarah Norton. And I thought, gosh, I want to know. I want to know what Erin writes. And it's a very clever idea, and it's about a rape. He said, she said. And our main characters Laura and Kit observe a rape, and we don't quite know why, but in the present day they are running from the woman who they saw raped, and we don't know why yet, and it's intriguing, and you know, it's a real page turner.
Well, that sounds like another one, but as I said, I'm not buying any more books till I finish the ones I've got. So Linda, how about you? What's on your bedside table?
Well, interestingly enough, I am writing about a coming-of-age novel, and so I've been looking into those. And here's one, Edisto by Paget Powell. And it's in the South, and I love Southern writing and Southern authors. And this is a really great coming-of-age novel. It has to do with the protagonist is named Simmons Everson Manigault, and he's 12 years old, and his mother and father disagree about the way he should be brought up. His mother wants him just to read, and, you know, be a real intellectual, and his father wants him to play baseball. And so the parents divorce, and he's left with his mother, who everyone calls the Empress, and he calls her the Doctor because she's just a very, well, you have to read the book to see what she's like, but it's a very interesting thing. And a man comes, is introduced, who is a black man who takes up residence in sort of in a house that used to be the servants' quarters. And he is mentoring this young man, I think because his mother wanted to have a male presence in his life. And this man who Simmons calls Taurus, he just nicknamed him Taurus, is a very interesting man, and he takes this young boy who's read everything and sounds already at 12 years old like he's a professor under his wing, and really the relationship between them and all that goes on with the mother, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting coming-of-age story, and I think it was Paget Powell's first novel. And he's written many, many since. He's an important Southern writer. But I highly recommend it if you're interested in coming of age.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Sounds great. Good. But I'm not buying it because I'm not buying any more books until I've read the ones I've got. We'd love to know what's on your bedside table too. I won't be buying it, but if you'd like to share with us what's on your bedside table, then please do. Just record a short piece that gives us the title and the author, why you chose the book and what it's about, but please no spoilers. And then email it to us at contributions@writeclubthepodcast.com. We'll post details of how to do that on our Facebook group, but we'd love to hear from you. So it's almost time to go, but before we do, can I ask you to do us just one favour? And that is to go on the site of whoever provides your podcast and leave us a 5-star review. That will encourage even more writers to join us. Don't forget to look for all the links to this week's show on our Facebook group. And until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye. Bye.